तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपारुता दे संगमतस धावरा ये सोरबंधा बमुंचंतु सतं.
So I apologize for giving you the five, but rather than go through the whole thing again, if you can just determine for Game Sumi Cha a Brahmacharya, and then Vikalapochana, not to take food at inappropriate times, and all the rest. I've been giving these precepts for so long. Now, when I give the precepts, it's a kind of meditation. I train myself so that the mind goes, I tune into the sound of silence, and then I, Bhutang Saranang Gacchami. Before I did this practice, then I'd do it in a kind of perfunctory way. And so I'd go, I know I had to give the three refuges, like Bhutang Saranang Gacchami, and then the people would repeat, and then sometimes I'd forget quite where I was at, because the mind would wander or something. And I forget, did I give the fourth precept, or... So or you can just rely on the momentum of the chanting itself. But then in developing this practice using sound of silence, and this puts me into a very mindful state, very present. And so then the Bhutang Saranang Gacchami comes out of that silence, rather than just the perfunctory reciting of Pali formulas. I encourage you to try that, the chanting and all that, the Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambhutasa can be just a perfunctory recitation of Pali. Or it actually can come out of the silence. And so to me this makes it more than just a ceremonial custom, tradition, Pali tradition, because one does, one begins to have doubts about that, whether it's necessary, and it oftentimes one gets rather bored with just repeating Pali chants and going through the formulas. So in integrating the ceremonial side of Theravada Buddhism this is the way I've done it. So it's not just going through the motions, and because it's part of a tradition, kind of dutifully doing the ceremonies. So I found that this way, that it has a potency to it, so you, this coming out of silence rather than me just trying to remember the Pali words. And then get it, because if I do that, if I come from just the thinking mind alone, then it does. You get your mind maybe distracted, and you can't quite remember. I've gone through the whole eight precepts and then wondered, and can't remember having said any of them. From just the kind of habitual style of giving the refuges and the precepts. So it's a way of training, it's always returning to pure presence, here and now, pachubandhantamma. As I said before, is a natural state. It's not created. And the reason why I emphasize this natural state is because, you know, we create ourselves, you know, so like the three fetters, Sakya, Ditti, Silabhata, Paramasa, Vichikicca, these are creations. They're extremities of some sort. They come and go and change. They arise and cease. Or you go into concentration, into absorptions, and they are very dependent on conditions supporting tranquility and absorption and so forth. And so they're conditioned. But the mindfulness practice, Sati Sampajanya, is actually recognizing natural state of consciousness. Consciousness where the creativity takes place in consciousness with intention rather than just the proliferating habits that we tend to keep reproducing endlessly into our consciousness through the self-view or the emotional habits or our desires and fears and so forth. So then in the, you know, like oneness, when we talk about dualism, you know, the where things are divided up, and the sensual world is because it's dualistic. So whatever begins will end. That's a dualism. It's a birth and death is a dualism. Day and night. Wherever you have one, you have the other. You know, so the conditioned realm has this dualism, and thought is dualistic, thinking. And so when we talk about mystical experience, that's usually the reality of oneness. But when you think about oneness, it doesn't work. Because then you get caught in theories or ideas, or maybe you had some kind of mystical insight or experience previously, but then you're attached to memory of it, you know, a memory of fear of experiencing oneness, and then you attach to the memory. So the Buddha encouraged us to really get to the source, you know, of this attachment, how we attach out of ignorance, out of habit, out of not really looking and examining and investigating experience, but merely operating from views, opinions, ideas, from the self-views, from the conventions, without getting beyond them, without having any reference beyond the conventional conditioned realm. So the only way that one can recognize the unconditioned reality is that's awareness. Aparuta de sangamatasatavara. So that is the gates to the deathless are open. So then using the word deathless or the unconditioned Nibbana, Amaravati, the name of this monastery, deathless realm, is that even though those are words, just like any other words, they're still, it's not to be defined or thought about, but recognized. So with Sati Sampajanya, mindfulness, you begin to like observe, you're recognizing the here and now. It's like this. It's awakening, noticing, attentiveness, paying attention to the way it is. It's non-critical, so it's not like you're saying it's better or worse or good or bad anymore, but it's discerning, the conditions arise and cease. So oneness then is reality. And that which is one is consciousness. Now this isn't a doctrine, that I don't want you to grasp this idea, but just reflect on it in terms of your own experience. because each one of us is experiencing consciousness. So recognizing this is that moment, that here and now, awakened observation, consciousness, before you create thoughts into it. Now, when I talk about sound of silence, I recognize this natural kind of energetic or vibration or whatever kind of background, which seems like a sound, but it's not really a sound. But this is the limitation of language. So I'm not trying to define it or kind of describe it so much as point to it. And then by recognizing this, then this is where, like when I say Bhutang Saranam Gacchami, I'm actually in this silence, this sound of silence. Because then the self disappears. The sense of separate self and me performing a ceremony or whatever. It just naturally ceases. There's still consciousness. Then the Bhutang Saranam Gacchami comes from that stillness or that silence rather than from me giving you the precepts, or Ajahn Sumedho is a preceptor giving precepts, and where it all becomes personal and separate. So this is like an attempt this evening just to try to point to this, because even the way we hold a convention of Buddhism can be from ignorance and self-view. As most of us start out with that, isn't it? We can't help but start out with our ignorance and a sense of me trying to understand and get somewhere and attain something and becoming a Theravadan Buddhist or becoming a bhikkhu or becoming this or that. These are the mind is programmed for this way of experiencing or life. So in consciousness I create myself, I be ordained as a bhikkhu, so I become a bhikkhu, Buddhist monk. But then the practice is using the Four Noble Truths, which is the first one is the recognizing dukkha, or this sense of dissatisfaction or longing or feeling a lack of something or something missing, an incompleteness. There can be wanting something we don't have yet that we would like to, or wanting to get rid of all our defilements and emotional problems and become an arahant or whatever. But all this is, this is the dukkha, no matter even if we grasp these beautiful concepts, these beautiful teachings, it's this basic sense of a self that's created out of ignorance, and the grasping that operates from that position is the cause of suffering. So this is like to examine that. Now that's very clear teaching, taking something quite ordinary, such as dukkha or suffering, and examining. Now the problem that most of us have in meditation is we're trying to think about it. We analyze, we create ourselves endlessly as Buddhists and as personalities and the view that we have about our attainments or lack of attainment. So it goes on endlessly, how one creates oneself, just becoming a samana, a monk or a nun, you still create yourself into that. But that's not the point, is it? It's not to take on just another mask or facade of some sort, another costume, but to use the convention for awakened awareness investigation of Dhamma or the way it is. Now it's interesting, now at this time in the Western world, there's so much interest now in emptiness or the Dzogchen practices in Tibetan Buddhism and in kind of Advaita approach, because this very much is quite direct in the sense that it is, there seems to be enough experience now among Westerners, Europeans, Americans, and so forth, in being able to be mindful or recognize or realize this reality of here and now. So rather, so we can start from suffering, because that's easy to see. Some people can't even admit they're suffering. They don't even know they're suffering. So you can't really, they just don't want to, they aren't ready to even recognize that. But most people that come, that I meet, are, pretty much aware of their unhappiness or their tendency to worry. And I mean, even if it's relatively, minor suffering, and in fact it's not a great trauma, but just the dreariness of life, the disappointment, the despair as you get older, unfulfilled wishes and disappointments and resentments that one accumulates on a personal level and through the experience and that one holds in memories. But also, if we don't bring to attention, like this awareness as the practice, if we still, many of us started to want to get samadhi, get jhanas, get concentrated states, get some kind of pleasant experience of tranquility or something from our practice, because that's how we're conditioned to think and to regard the universe around us through controlling the mind, through working hard, through concentrating the mind, and learning to have these control mechanisms where we can focus on one thing and absorb into it. But still, I mean, that's good, that's a good thing to do. It's not something to despise. It can be skillful. But getting to the real source, then, is in recognizing the suffering of self, the self-view. It's the first fetter, the saṅyojana, is in the 10 fetter list. So this first fetter, the first saṅyojana, is sakya-ditti, self-view or personality view. Now this, I encourage you over and over again to be aware of the self. You're not trying to get rid of self or judge it. It's not an attack or an annihilation of self, but a recognition. When we talk about self, what we're talking about is sakya-ditti, the self we create into consciousness. We're not talking about consciousness. We're talking about what we create out of ignorance. So this is sakya-ditti. So sometimes we can grasp the teachings of the Buddha and say we've got to get rid of all selfishness or all self. We've got to become selfless. And this can be another form of self, isn't it? I'm somebody who's trying to get rid of selfishness. And I've got to, destroy the self to realize, to be that oneness of anatta or nibbana. can still be, you know, when you think in this way, it's still sakyaditti, isn't it? Still a sense of, I'm somebody doing something. I've got to get something or attain something I don't have yet. By getting rid of this ego, this selfishness, this sense of me and mine. So when we investigate in experience the here and now Dhamma with this sound of silence, this, because that is like emptiness, consciousness, emptiness, and then in this stillness, there's no, you know, I'm not creating anything. I'm not creating myself. So what I'm experiencing then is this stillness, this what I call silence, or like a vibratory sound, has a continuity, a flowing quality. And I don't create it. It's not like imagined or created. Now, just learning to rest in this stillness, then the any remnants of self-view and me and mine disappear. Because the flowing, that flow is, you know, it has a continuity. It doesn't begin and end. Like sounds, ordinary sounds that we make with our voices or bird song or music or whatever, has a beginning and end. So it, you know, it does, one does have this sense of this beginning and ending of things. But this sound of silence then is like space, visual space, or I call it the reality, a sign or recognition of consciousness. Because there's consciousness and awareness, and then there's panya, or wisdom, discernment. And so from this, then this is where, say, these practices that come from the mindfulness practices are always pointing to this, to recognize it, because it's here and now. It's not something, it's not an attained state, it's just recognize, learning to recognize. Just this. So it's like listening with patience and kind of relaxed, patient listening, recognizing. And how the mind will produce all kinds of doubts about it, and self-views, you know, will come forth, because emotionally we're not programmed, we're not conditioned for the unconditioned. You know, as personalities and culturally, we're programmed for happiness and suffering and success and failure and praise and blame and so forth. We want the best, and we don't want the worst. We want to go to heaven, not to hell. We want happiness and peace and love and all the best, and we don't want war and pain and misery and rejection, anger and hatred. So emotionally we tend to, you know, how we can kind of react emotionally when somebody praises me, you know, they say, "You're a great teacher, wonderful teacher, Ajahn Sumedho," and then praise feels like this. You know, on the sakyaditti level, it reaffirms a sense of my self-importance, my attainments, that I'm accepted or appreciated, I'm respected. So there's a feeling of happiness or ease or that through praise on the personal level. Or if somebody, you know, starts criticizing or blaming me and abusing me verbally, you know, they say, "You're no good, you don't know what you're talking about, you're..." Then on the sakyaditti level, it feels, you know, you feel angry or hurt or offended or misunderstood or exasperated. So these emotions, you know, they're conditioned through the eight worldly dhammas, the success and failure, happiness, suffering, praise and blame, this dualism of the conditioned realm. So this is where, you know, you can't trust your, the emotions are what they are, you know, and I'm not, you know, people criticize and blame me, you know, I've never learned to feel happy about that. Somebody says, you're a disgusting old pig, you know. You know, it doesn't rouse happiness in my mind, but it rouses, you know, of being offended, personally being offended. But there's an awareness of this, isn't it? You can be aware of being offended or being exhilarated by praise. And so this is where, you know, the mindfulness is to recognize this natural state where we can, you know, we have a reference point, we have perspective on the worldly dhammas that we have to live with. We have to live with the bodies we have, with the emotional habits that we've acquired, with our memories, our personalities, our melodramas, our obsessions and fears and doubts and worries. But our relationship to it changes from grasping, ignorance and grasping, and being caught in the momentum of emotional up and down, isn't it? Like if you're just emotional, then you go up and down all the time. You're just kind of a helpless victim. And things are going well, you're happy, things are going all wrong, you're miserable. And there's emotions of happy, miserable, happy, miserable, bored, fed up, absolutely fantastic. And go from you know, from one extreme to the next. Or sometimes, you know, when life gets really, in the monastic life, you know, where we really get fed up with it, is when it's not extreme, when it gets boring. Routine thing, morning chanting, evening chanting, you know, not even opera or anything, you can, namo tassa, monotone chanting. You can express your true creativity and your inner soul on a personal level because you're bound to a tradition that insists on monotone chanting. And so we get bored and fed up. But these are also emotions. I mean, being bored and being fed up and so forth, these are emotional habits, you know, because we would like to be happy, blissed out, you know, to be, have life as an experience of the absolutely fantastic. So that's why pointing to pure consciousness or sound of silence or space, just contemplating visual space, you know, you're learning to recognize, you're recognizing that which is here and now, which has no extremity to it. It is what it is. When is space good or bad, or is it beautiful, ugly, you know, it's spacious. Or consciousness, is it absolutely fantastic or absolutely miserable? Or what we create into consciousness and into space can be, you know, space can, you know, beauty or ugliness can enter our visual, enter a room, and we are affected by the beautiful or the ugly accordingly. Or consciousness, we can create hell or heaven in consciousness. But to awaken, like Bhutto, Bhutang Sarnangachami, this the very name of the Buddha is significant because it's awakened consciousness. Now this is about you. each one of us. It's not about, you know, some Buddha or somebody who's very advanced and somebody in the past or somebody in the Himalayan mountains that's fully enlightened Arahant or whatever. It's about you and me right now. It's not, we're not pointing to far away or somebody else. Because you have to admit, you're, each one of you is conscious, experiencing consciousness right now. Anyone unconscious right now? Now the sense of a self is a real burden, you know, like self-consciousness, and because on, you know, one is, you know, on the worldly level, the eight worldly dhammas, there's always so much concern about, you know, what people think, how do I look, what do people think of me, you know, not wanting to stand out, wanting to, you know, if, talking today with someone about having to stand out in a crowd or say something in public, and you can get very nervous. You know, just suddenly you say, like, taking the precepts, and suddenly you're the one, somebody is focused on you, and you have to recite Bana, Adibata, where you can feel very upset or nervous or anxious, just even though you may have done it 100 times. Because the self is like that. You're putting yourself out in a position where you can be, you can make mistakes, you can screw everything up, you can do something wrong, you can make a fool of yourself. You're standing out in some way that can be, to the ego, is very, can be very threatening. So, like, in my own practice, training myself, I remember in the Navy when I first, I enlisted in the Navy when I was 19 years old. And so then you go into these boot camps, and they flew me down from Seattle, Washington to San Diego, California. First time away from home. And put you in these, what they call boot camps or training camps. First thing they do is they shave your head. So they shave my hair off like it is now. They put you in, they give you these, what they call dungarees. So they give you these baggy trousers and shirts, kind of like denim, called dungarees. And white hats, and we're all young youths from all over the States. So we all come with our own style, our own kind of clothes and hairstyle and whatever. And then within a few hours, we're all looking like plucked chickens. You know, look pathetic. I remember. And then, of course, this is a military outfit, so they yell at you all the time and call you every foul thing they can think of. So they say, "You idiot," and you say, "Yes, sir." Well, when you're not in the military, they say, "You idiot," those are fighting words, you know. But in training, you just say, this is part of the game, you know. So you really don't take it that personally. Because everybody's been called an idiot. But then when you do have to stand out and say something or that, it's scary. Because also they've got power and can punish you or humiliate you. You know, so I used to be petrified half the time in group scenes in the military. Because standing out was dangerous. You could really be punished or persecuted for saying something that they didn't want to hear or didn't like, or make a fool of yourself. Well, these condition you, and there's a conditioning process, this sense of self, learning how to be politically correct, say it in a nice way, play the game properly, survive in the system. It's all about the eight worldly dhammas, learning how to get through the family, the parents that you have, so that they aren't always persecuting you or punishing you. You learn how to get along in school, how to get along, you know, so the teacher, you and the teacher, you know, bring her an apple. The apple polishers. Other less poetic words for that. But it's a way of surviving, learning to survive in the system, in the school system, in the family system, in the military, in the society, in the university, in the office, in the factory, wherever. So we are programmed, you know, how to survive on that conditioned level of reward and punishment. Like being praised is a reward, isn't it? Being punished is its opposite. So, you know, when you contemplate your personality, you know, this is just the way we are, and this is the way the world, the culture operates, whatever society is in. It has its own values and its own rights and wrongs and shoulds and shouldn'ts. You know, whether you're in America or Britain or Thailand or wherever, you know, China or Japan or wherever, you've got, you know, you have the reward punishment as part of the conditioning process, what I call kind of what we call civilization. And we pick that up, you know, learn how to survive in the system, get along in the system. So I remember when the hippie movement began to reach Thailand, back in the, this is about early 70s, and I was a monk with Ajahn Chah, and hippies, you know, they started getting publicity in the Bangkok newspapers, and they always had bad publicity because they were associated with drugs and immoral behavior. And they weren't neat and dressed, you know, in nice suits and things. They had long hair and beards and wore all kinds of strange paraphernalia and whatnot. And so they looked, you know, really weird and strange and alien and untrustworthy to the people in Thailand at that time. And so they got terrible press, you know. So they were all just a bunch of degenerate drug addicts, and you know, no good types. And so, anyway, Lungpa Cha, I remember we were discussing, this was brought to his attention, hippies need. So he asked me, he says, "What is a hippie?" And I said, "Oh, they're people that have seen through the hypocrisy of the system, and they refuse to cooperate." And he said, oh, he said, "They should become monks." He said, "Go to Bangkok and bring them to Wat Bapo." Oh, we didn't have to do that. They started drifting there anyway. So, but it's interesting, because, you know, the monasticism, you know, is in Thailand, it's a way out of the system. The social system or the expectations of the worldly values of that society. Become a Meiti, a nun or a monk or whatever, it gives you an option out to operate outside. But it's not, but it isn't just, you know, of course it is based on precepts. So we refrain from taking drugs and drink, and we're celibate and so forth. So this is not like, you know, exploring every sensual opportunity or, you know, throwing away the values of your society is an act of rebellion. But for me, it gave an option, a way of stepping out of the society and the pressures of that society to reflect and contemplate the meaning of life. What am I here for anyway? What is the purpose of life? Because when I entered the monastic life, I was pretty fed up with it. Not with monasticism, but with the lay life. Because, I had enough experience to, it all became meaningless for me. And just seeking happiness and sensual pleasure and all that, after so much of that, it just was boring. And it didn't create a sense of self-respect. I just seemed to go into kind of a drifting mode of just getting by. So the monastic life, I experienced it in Thailand, and then I found this very good teacher, Lungpo Cha, who was very strict on the disciplinary side. So this put me into, this was quite a challenge to conform, because my whole personality was based on the ideal of individuality and nonconformity. I considered myself as a person a nonconformist, because that's my self-image. I had a kind of snooty contempt for these stupid middle-class conformists. So I could be just as snobbish as they could in my own way. So this is individuality and my creative habits and me and self-expression and all that. I had an opportunity to explore that, because in my own society and in my generation, there was that, opportunity to explore the extremities of sense experience and so forth, or personality. But at the end of the day, it's just miserable. Dukkha became so strong. And yet it wasn't because of being called an idiot or it was just this sense of incompleteness, of meaninglessness, purpose. Life had no purpose to it. And so in this, because I did have this confidence, or something in me responded and felt such a connection to the teachings of the Buddha, that this obviously, was, and living in Southeast Asia, then I had the chance to investigate and explore the possibility in Thailand. Well, then of course, in the training and that, with the emphasis that Lungpo Cha made on practice, it was always, the whole point was this awakened attention. So it wasn't just a reward and punishment for, getting praise for being a good monk and going through the same, developing the same habits only within a more kind of an unusual style, lifestyle. But getting to the root of the cause of suffering, ignorance, attachment to conditions out of ignorance. So then this awakenedness, this sati sampajanya, now this is the essence. This is the essence of the Buddha's teaching, this emphasis on mindfulness. Because this is the only opportunity we have to be free from suffering, is through awareness. Otherwise, we're merely caught into the conditions. We lose perspective because we're always being influenced and overwhelmed by our habits, our memories, our thoughts, and so forth. And the only way to get out of that vortex is through awareness. So when we say the gate to the deathless, the door to the deathless is open, aparuta de sangamatasatavara, that means To me, that means that means this awareness is the gate. Just this simple attentiveness in the present. Now then, as I began to recognize it, because before I tried to, I wanted concentration, so I'd get confused all the time about concentrating the mind, because there's so much sense of, you know, trying to hold on or get something, or a tranquil state, wanting tranquility. And fortunately, Lung Po Cha was the kind of, he never let me get too tranquil, because his aim was to really open me to the present moment, wherever I was, whatever I was doing. So the monastic form began to make sense as a way of living, because, you know, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, putting on your robes, making your robes, dyeing your robes, washing them, or eating your, going on the alms round, eating food, just the most ordinary, banal things that one does in one's daily life was included, you know. It wasn't just sitting in samadhi in a quiet place. So I found, you know, at first I felt quite rebellious towards this, because I'm personally, I like samadhi a lot. I like to go into tranquility, shut everything out, all the confusing worldly conditions, and go into a nice, tranquil samadhi state, quite like that. But, you know, then one, you know, if you have no perspective on that, then you resent everything else. Your life is just, all you're doing is living for the next chance for samadhi, where the awareness is, means that you become aware of that, of the desire to get something you don't have, or the desire to get rid of the noise and confusion or distraction. You begin to awaken and observe these desires, you know, wanting to get rid of wandering mind, boredom, anger, greed, whatever, or wanting to achieve and attain samadhi or nibbana or arahantship or whatever, you know. It's still desire. So this second noble truth is the really, you know, the study of desire. And because in consciousness, desire arises and ceases in consciousness. Consciousness is not desire. So, and yet desires, wanting sensual desire, wanting pleasurable sense experiences, or desire to attain and achieve, or desire to get rid of the noise and confusion, these desires, they arise and cease. So our relationship then to desire is a knowing relationship rather than an attempt to get rid of it or suppress desire, but to recognize it. So that which can recognize it, like consciousness, as we're experiencing it right now, we can actually be aware of the desires that we're experiencing here and now. If we're not mindful and we don't notice desire, then we tend to just be pulled into it. You know, we just caught into every desire that goes through our consciousness, helpless victims of it. But if we recognize it, then desires come and go according to conditions. But, you know, they are what they are, and our relationship to them is knowing, is the bhuto. Pure awareness, pure consciousness, and seeing and recognizing the suffering we create by attaching to desire out of this ignorance. And so this is, you know, this is the whole point of our life and practice, so that you, if the deathless, the unconditioned, nibbana, the Pali word anatta, non-self, isn't an annihilation of consciousness, is it? It's not to kill yourself, slit your throat or something, but to recognize, realize your true nature is this. So in, say, this monastic form, you know, how to use it for that, you know, to not to use it for worldly values or attainments or causes or things like that. But if we do that, if we begin to recognize the suffering we create by wanting and not wanting. So in my own life as a monk, you know, this is a great opportunity, you know, I've had, which I look back on now, I'm forever grateful, because, you know, the suffering that I used to experience, I don't have that. I mean, I've studied, examined it, explored it, to be able to let go of the causes for that sense of a self, or worry, anxiety, self-consciousness, fears, jealousies, despair, boredom, and these and so much negative emotions, that I was involved with on a personal level. Well, through this kind of practice, now, after 40 years, I know better. And if you've studied something, examined something that long, you know, it's just the result of cultivating this way. And so when I talk about consciousness now, what I'm trying to do is this encouragement to begin to just trust the simplicity of awakeness, and just the recognition, and not judge yourself or think about yourself or believe any of the things you do think about yourself. We think about ourselves in terms of values, of being good, bad, or right or wrong, or whatever, but these thoughts still arise in my mind. It's that I don't have them, but I know what they are. I know them, so I don't grasp. I determine not to grasp them or operate from those perceptions. But they still come and go according to condition, like the moon, phases of the moon, and whatnot. So, this is encouragement, to reflect on how to use the monasticism, not for personal identity or become anything. It's merely an expedient means for awareness. That's its purpose. It's not meant to be an identity that we are attached to. But we do attach to it, because that's our habit. And then so that, therefore, the encourage, you know, the, but then the suffering that results, there's always unhappiness or blaming or complaining or resentments and things you don't like about the convention. Things that irritate you about it, things you resent, if we spend our monastic life trying to make the convention what we want, we've kind of wasted our life. But it is the way it is, based on moral principles and on awareness. I mean, this is, you know, in terms of a convention, it's adequate for seeing clearly if we use it for what it's meant to be used for. So I offer this as a reflection.